Okay, can you hear me now? Outstanding. You probably first thing you noticed is I'm overdressed, right? My fancy suit. I look good? Well, if it helps take things down a notch, it's a Goodwill suit. I paid $12 for it, 50 cents for the tie, and $5 for the shoes. But sometimes I have to go to meetings where if you don't wear the right uniform, they don't want to hear your message. And so in my closet, I got uniforms for the occasion. Sometimes I go to meetings with big shots in the state, and if I don't look right, they don't have to listen to my message. So I wore my best Sunday go to meeting clothes today, but I didn't spend more than $20 on it. So that being said, Pastor Ben has set the bar pretty high for me today, and so maybe I better accomplish a couple of tasks right off the bat. If you could amuse me by just standing up for a moment. Everybody just stand up. And then if you could place your hand over your heart for just a moment, feel your heart beating. Okay, very good. Thank you. Thank you for indulging me. Now you can be seated. Now you can go home and with honesty, when your neighbor asks you, how was church today, you can say, my spirit was lifted and my heart was touched. Regardless of what I have to say, you had an honest answer you can give. Okay, so today's message is about foster care and adoption. And I've been working in this business for about 25 plus years in two different states. So I started out in California. In fact, that's where I was born and raised, in San Diego, California. And about 15 years ago, we moved to Indiana and did the same thing here, working with kids. Indiana is in a crisis right now in its foster care system and has been for a number of years. When I started in the Indiana system in 2004, there was about 8,000 kids in the system. I got on the computer last night and looked at our AFCAR stats, and it hit me like a freight train. If the trend continues, by the end of the year, we will have put 25,000 kids in the system. Our case managers have not increased that significantly. I think when I started, we had about 1,100 case managers, and I think we're at 1,700 now. Our foster homes haven't increased like that. Back in 2005, I think the number was somewhere around 4,000 foster homes. And Faye, do you know the number today? I think it's sitting around 7,000, 7,500 for 25,000 kids. So I think you're beginning to see the scope of the problem. If you listen to our state legislature or you watch the news, the problem seems to be drugs. At least that's what we're told. And there's some credence to that. Statistically, 85% of the homes we take kids from have a parent that's got a substance abuse problem. They're a drug addict. So that's a huge chunk of the homes we're taking kids from. And of course, the pat answer for our politicians to solve this problem is to pass laws. And if you've been in this business long enough, you'll know that, oh, there was a time when it was crack cocaine that was the evil villain that was putting kids in the system, and then it went to methamphetamine, and now it's synthetic heroin. And so we're passing laws to make that more difficult to get, the synthetic heroin. But I think really, if you peel the onion back far enough, you'll see that it's actually drug use is a symptom of the problem. And in the problem, it's almost as if many don't want to look at it, the problem. They'd rather deal with the symptom, which then never fixes the problem. The problem is, if you go into these homes, there's very little hope. Want to be honest about this? I call it planet chaos. And you don't have to be on drugs to live in planet chaos, but if I come in your home, I can sense a planet chaos because there's very little hope going on. And when you don't have a life that has much hope, you want to escape that. And what's your method of escape? It could be drugs, it could be pornography, it could be gambling. Oh, there's a plethora of things that will go escape a world that seems hopeless. And the byproduct of that is going to be a child that's wounded. And that's the child that's coming in our nets. So these Planet Chaos kids, that I call them, are coming from homes where the parents have chosen to escape reality. That leaves the child wired very differently than perhaps what you were expecting a child to be. So if you were going to take in a foster kid, there's a good probability that you're going to get a child that's wired for Planet Chaos. Right? And Planet Chaos wiring means that their belief system is going to be different than your or my belief system. Meaning how they see adults, they probably view them as scary people. You can't trust them. They're going to hurt you. What do they think of themselves? Well, it's a direct reflection of how they're parented. They probably see themselves as pretty worthless, as unlovable. Who was loving them? You know, we go through some pretty important stages in life. Probably the most important, the 0 to 3 years of our life, is where our relationship blueprint gets written. From when we're born until about age 3, we have our relationship blueprint, part of our brain, being written. And it's being written by the primary caregiver around us. So now think about Planet Chaos kids and think about what their relationship blueprint is going to look like. Can you kind of get an idea of what that's going to be? We carry this relationship blueprint with us for the rest of our life. So you might know a 50-year-old who can't get along with anybody, been through a series of relationships, and you're thinking, what's wrong with that person? Truthfully, you got to go back to when they were 0 to 3 and figure out what's going on. Who wrote that blueprint? Because we use it for the rest of our life. Now, is it healable? I mean, if you get a bad blueprint, relationship blueprint, is that healable? Can you fix that? The answer is yes, but it's not easy. In fact, our social scientists call this the attachment process, and if you don't get a good one, the worst it could be is what we call reactive attachment disorder, and that's where a child goes 0 to 3 and doesn't attach to anybody ever. Their blueprint's pretty bumpy. That child's going to be a very difficult child to parent, very difficult child to heal. But healing, yes, it is possible. The bigger question is, do we adults have time to heal that child? That's the bigger question. See, if it took 3 years to write that blueprint, how long do you think it's going to take to heal it? A week? A month? If it's a reactive attachment disorder, you're probably looking at anywhere from 4 to 7 years of intense relationship-based healing with that child before you can see healing. Okay, well, I guess that's where you guys come in. So we got 25,000 kids out there in this state. And by the way, just in case you're wondering, Indiana leads the nation in per capita kids in foster care. How about that? Pastor Ben talked about how this is Orphan Month, right? Orphan Week. Orphan Sunday. The roots of that, I'm going to digress here for a minute. The roots of that, give you a little history on this. The roots of that was the Orphan Train. Anybody heard of the Orphan Train? Some of you? Yeah. In about 1870, orphan kids, for the first, 150 years of this country, wasn't a government problem. It was a church problem. So when you had an orphan kid, the churches dealt with it or nobody dealt with it. Right? Well, if you think about New York City and Boston and Philadelphia, in 1870, there was several hundred thousand orphan kids living on the street. Nobody knew what to do with. Well, there was a pastor who got this brilliant idea that folks are heading west and they need help on the farm. Why don't we round these kids up and put them on a train and send it west until the train's empty? And so that's what they did. And hundreds of thousands of kids were adopted that way from about 1870 to about 1930. They had the orphan train running in this country. So you'd get a flyer a week in advance that the orphan train's coming this Saturday, and you'd go to the train depot and wait for them to unload, and they'd line them up, and you pick the one you want, that one and maybe that one. And the others would get on the train and go to the next town. And that's how adoptions were handled, I don't know, for the first 70 years or so in this country. That was kind of a hit and miss thing, right? Sometimes I imagine that would work out pretty well, and sometimes that wouldn't be so well. And if you're 12 years old and you got the wrong home and you're in the middle of Kansas, there's not a lot of options there. It was about in the 1960s in the Great Society under Lyndon Johnson that the government started stepping up into the child welfare business. And we've kind of transferred the reins from churches and families over to the idea that government solves all this problem. And I think the pendulum may have swung too far, because now we have most people in society think, oh, the government, let's just call DCS and have them fix that problem. Why won't DCS do something about that? We're drowning. Obviously, this isn't going to be a government solution. It's going to take all of us solution. And as I look back through the years of being in this business, I'm reminded of the many instances in which folks like you have stepped up to the plate and taken in foster care kids, wounded kids, trauma wounded kids, and healed them. In Terre Haute, when I first arrived at the DCS out there, I got introduced to a foster parent named Darla Schaefer. And at that point, she'd been foster parenting probably about 30 years. And everybody in the office said, Darla's where you send your most troubled teenagers. So if you can think of a tier level for foster care, the first tier is your typical foster home, like your home. We put the child with you. And if that doesn't work, then we do what's called a group home placement. It's the next notch up for a more difficult to parent child. And if that doesn't work, then we use what's called an institutional placement. And that's where they got a secure, usually a fence around the property, and it seems more like a youth detention place, but we call it our institutional placements. And that's for the most difficult to manage children. And there actually is a fourth level before you get into the incarceration stage. And the fourth level is really hard to get there. But that's with our state mental hospital down in Evansville. So in this tier process, the word on the street in DCS in Region 8 was, if you got a troubled teen, you stick it with Darla Schaefer before you try a group home, before you leave the foster parent folks. And so I went out and met Darla the first time, and dropping off a 15-year-old, a troublemaking 15-year-old. And that was my first interaction with Darla, and I got to know her quite well over the next 4 or 5 years and taking kids out to her home. And one day, walking back to my car with Darla after dropping a kid off, she turns to me and she says, Mr. Wilkinson, when are you going to bring me a baby? And I turned to her and I laughed. By this point, Darla was probably 62 years old. And I said, Darla, you don't care for babies. You care for teenagers. And she said, Mr. Wilkinson, when you get back to the office, will you look at my home study? I said, okay. Back to the office, and I pulled out her home study. And she started foster parenting when she was 28 years old. And in her home study, her and her husband said they're getting in this to get a baby because they couldn't have children. And some desperate case manager, their first placement was a teenager. And they took that child. It wasn't the path they wanted, but they said it was the path that God chose for them. And so they took that teenager. Over the next 35, 37 years, I think she was foster parent, she took in over 100 kids. Her husband passed away when she was about 58, and she continued foster parenting. She never got her baby. She passed away about 2 years ago, and I attended her funeral. And the amazing thing to me was, in the chapel where they were holding her services sat at least 70 adults who called her mom. This woman who never had any biological children. who only parented teenagers. Left behind a chapel full of adults who call her mom. I wish we had more Darla Shavers. Another foster parent that touched my life. I went out and did a home study. Oh, it's probably been 10 years ago, out in Brazil, Indiana. What made this one interesting was the husband and wife that were wanting to be licensed foster parents were in their late 50s. And I sat down in their home, and the husband turned to me and said, "Mr. Wilkinson, I got to be honest with you. This is her idea, his wife's." He said, "This is my first marriage and her second." He said, "I don't have any children, and my wife thinks it's a good idea that I try being a parent." He said, "Mr. Wilkinson, I don't know anything about parenting." He said, "I only know hunting, fishing, and farming." And I said, "Perry, you know exactly what it takes to parent a child." He rolled his head back and laughed at me. Over the next 8 years, we put 15 kids in Perry and Bab's home. And every one of those kids left knowing how to fish. Now that might not seem like much to you, but keep in mind what kind of kid we're putting in that home. A kid who thinks zero of themselves, is good at absolutely nothing, believes you can't trust adults because they're going to do evil to you. And now think about the kid that leaves that home. Boy or girl, they left that home knowing how to fish. Perry knew how to fish. I kid you not. I went fishing with him one day because I wanted to see what in the world he's doing with these kids. He had a tackle box. First thing he said was, "What kind of fish you want to catch?" I didn't know we get a choice. I'm just used to throwing something out there and hoping something grabs it. He said, "You want to catch catfish, bluegill, bass? What do you want to catch?" Yeah, and within 5 minutes, he'd pull in a fish of whatever we're trying to catch. That man was a fisherman. He patiently and lovingly taught every one of those kids how to fish that came through his house. And I'll give you another little picture of this. I put about a 7-year-old boy in his house, and I didn't tell him how bad of a behaved child this was. In fact, this kid was headed to institutional placement, and I talked my office into one more chance with Perry and Bab. Okay, one more chance before we ship this kid off to institutional placement. 7 years old. He was in their home almost 18 months, and for the first 8 or 9 months, I didn't know this until a few years later, but Perry told me a few years later, he said, "You know, every month you'd come on that kid, come over to our house to check on him, we'd made our mind up to give him back because he was so difficult to parent. We didn't think we could do it." And he said, "Each time we were just about ready to do it, he would do or say something that would give us hope. And we'd say, let's try one more month." And they did. It took some time to heal that boy. He was a pretty trauma-wounded kid. Perry said that the turning point in the relationship with that, at that point, 8-year-old boy, was that they were fishing at a lake together. Him and what every one of those foster kids said was Grandpa. Him and Grandpa were fishing at the lake. And some other folks were at the lake fishing too. And there's only two people at the lake pulling fish out of the water. It was the boy and Grandpa. And as most of us probably could imagine, when someone's catching fish, other people start scooting closer. That must be where the fish are. We'll get some of that. Perry said this city slicker kept coming closer and closer with his new pole and fancy tackle box until he was almost next to the boy, he said, and the boy's pole went down for a fish and hit the other fellow's pole went down too, and by the time we got them to the shore, they both had the same fish. The lines were tangled. He said it took us about 5 minutes to untangle those lines and find out that it's the boy's fish. And he said that city slicker took his pole and snapped it in half and threw his tackle box in the bushes and stomped off. And that eight-year-old boy turned to Perry and said, "Grandpa, what's wrong with that man?" And Perry bent down to him and said, "Son, you just outfished a man. He's mad about that." For that eight-year-old boy, that was the first time in his life he ever did anything amazing. And you can mark a line in the sand and how his behavior started to change when he started seeing himself as worthwhile. We heal through relationships. Yeah. Amazing healing happens when we have the patience and kindness to care for a child and relate to him. We have another hero I'll call. I'd like to bring up, paint the story of. Her name is Jean McBride, and she retired from foster parenting about 5 years ago. And she was a foster parent for, at least 30 years. And in 30 years, she had 270 babies placed in her home. 270. Now, what made Jean McBride unique is that when she started this process, she had 4 children of her own. And she felt the call to help. But she felt a unique call. She said, "Darren, I've known all my life that I have a gift with babies." And so when she was licensed years ago, she said, "I just want to help babies." And she said, "I just want to help sick babies." What? Yeah. So our medical fragile babies, that's the term we have for medically fragile babies, were placed with Jean McBride. And she'd have them anywhere from 1 month to 3 or 4 months. But that was about her limit. She wanted to get the babies well and then hand them off to a family that either wanted to have reunification happen or they wanted to adopt the baby. She wasn't in it for adoption. She was in it to heal babies. 270 plus babies, 30 years. Sometimes I would have Jean ride in my car to a doctor's appointment or other type of appointment, and she, as we're driving down the street, she'd point out adults living in homes. She said, I cared for that man there when he was a baby. He doesn't know it. She kept a journal with pictures, their names, and how things went when she cared for them. Our town's littered with successful adults that spent 1 to 3 months with Jean McBride. At the worst moment in her life, some of these babies were put there to die. Yep, we've had babies put in Jean McBride's home, and the doctors say, "Baby's not going to make it. But it's probably better that the baby die at home." And they get healed. I was at Riley Hospital with Jean McBride, and the nurses knew Jean. She regularly trips to Riley Hospital. We were there to pick up a medically fragile baby and bring it back to Terre Haute, to Jean's home. And she had to be checked out on the procedures, that medical procedures she had to do with this infant once we get it home. But the nurses there were giving her hugs and renewing relationships, and one of them said, "Jean, we have a baby that we've been working with for last 10 days to take a bottle and it won't. Would you try?" Jean McBride, with no medical training, being asked by a nurse at Riley Hospital to try to feed a baby. Within less than 10 minutes, the baby was taking a bottle. Jean McBride has a gift. Healing babies. I can't explain it. I don't even think the doctors can explain it. But I'm a firm believer that we all have gifts. And I don't know where your gift is, but best I can tell, this thing called Christianity that we believe in, the scriptures are full with it. It's a relationship-based stuff. I think at the end of the day, when we turn in our scorecard, I think God's going to be looking at our relationships and the strength of them. I think that's a big area we're going to be judged on. And I think each of us have gifts in that area if we want to explore them. My wife and I take a couples trip once a year somewhere where we can just get away and kind of emotionally recharge and keep our relationship strong. And so a couple years ago, we decided to go to Disneyland, California. Remember, I grew up in Southern California, and so that was my park, Disneyland, California. So we went out there for 3 days to spend at Disneyland. And about day two, we were riding the train that goes around the park, and it stops at each of the five lands in Disneyland, right? And as it's going around the park, it pulls up to New Orleans Square, and Disneyland's always crowded. The train's pretty full, and as we're sitting on the train looking at the folks that are going to be getting on, I see someone in the crowd that looks really familiar, and I turn to my wife and I say, "Honey, I think I know that man." Well, she's been married to me long enough to know that that's usually not a good sign based on my business. And she said, "No, you don't." And I'm studying, and I'm racking my brain with where would I know that guy from? And as luck would have it, him and his wife come up and sit down right next to us on the train. Two seats right there, sit down next to me. My wife keeps elbowing me. "Don't. Don't. I can't help it." Train gets going, and I turn to him and I say, "So where are you folks from?" And he says he's from New York. And I said, "Well, that's odd. What are you doing at Disneyland, California? Don't you live closer to Disney World in Florida?" He laughs and he says, "That's right. Me and my wife usually do go to Disneyland, Florida." He said, "In fact, this is the first time we've ever been to Disneyland, California." He said, "But I felt compelled that we needed to come to Disneyland, California." And then he turned to me and said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "I'm from Indiana." He laughs and he says, "You're at the wrong part too, buddy." I said, "I know. I grew up coming to this park, so this is my park." And then he said, "You know, that's interesting that you're from Indiana." He said, "I was born in Indiana." He said, "I'm adopted. But I was born in a little small town in Indiana. You probably never heard of it." I said, "Try me." He said, "Terre Haute." I said, "That's where I'm from." "No kidding." He said, "Well, you know, my adoptive parents have told me my birth parents' name, but I can't remember." He says, "I'm going to call my mom right now and get their names and see if you know them." So he dials on his cell phone middle of the day. And the typical conversation you can imagine that a mother would have when her adult son calls her middle of the day on a vacation: "You okay? Is the train okay? You're on?" "Yeah, everything's fine." Finally gets down to, "I'm sitting next to a guy from Indiana." "I know, Mom. That's why I called. What's their names?" He repeats the names out loud of his birth parents. My stomach goes in a knot. He hangs up the phone and turns to me and says, "Do you know either of my birth parents?" And I said, "Yes, I do. The reason why I recognize this guy is because he's a spitting image of his birth father. Looked like Grizzly Adams, about 6'2", 230 pounds. Looks like he wrestled a bear. That's who's sitting next to me." He said, "Can you tell me anything about my birth parents?" His birth parents were two of the sorriest parents I've ever worked with. They're still making poor choices today. I turn to him and I say, "Yeah. The next time you see your adopted parents, you give them a big hug. Because they saved you from a whole bunch of ugliness. Your birth parents have made a lifetime of bad choices, and they're still making them today." It got quiet. He just stared ahead, and I saw tears coming out of his eyes. He'd been wanting his whole life to know about his birth parents. And my wife's just glaring at me. I wasn't going to say anything else. The train's moving along, and he finally turns to me and he says, I got one more question. Do I look like either of my birth parents? I've wanted to know that my whole life. I said, yeah. You look almost identical to your birth father. But I want you to know this, sir. You also look almost identical to your birth uncle, who also lives in Terre Haute, who has a family of 5 kids, who has a successful business and is a pillar in our community. And I said, I want to remind you that life's about choices. You make good choices in life, you're going to get good outcomes. If you make bad choices, you're going to get bad outcomes. And I said, sir, it's clear to me that you've made good choices in your life and you're getting good outcomes. But the next stop, my wife nudges me, let's get off the train. It's awkward. And we get up to leave, and he stands up and gives me a big bear hug and hands me a business card and says, if you see my uncle, could you give him my card? I said I would, and we got off the train. As we're walking away, I looked at his card, and I said, honey, look at this card. He works for Disney Corporation. He's a Pixar computer animator. You'll see his names on a lot of their Pixar movies. What's the moral of that story? First, if you don't think there's a higher power in charge, I don't know how else to explain that, what just happened there. Second, from two of the most unfortunate humans I've ever worked with came an amazing man. And that was a direct result of who parented him. When I got back to Terre Haute, I found the uncle and shared the car with him, and he cried too. He said, those folks, I knew this because we took all, they had 8 kids, and that one I met in Disneyland was their oldest. I took the last 2. But the uncle said, we knew where all 7 kids had gone, but the first one we never knew what happened to. And he said, thank you so much. So, we're back to you again. We need help. Some of you have amazing gifts to help. And maybe your calling isn't going to be a foster parent. Maybe your calling isn't going to be to adopt a child. But I hope you can see the problem's big enough that it needs your help. Maybe your help's going to be in focusing on one of your grandkids. Maybe your help is going to be on focusing on a kid in this church who needs extra parenting help, who needs a healthy, loving, kind relationship in their life. Maybe your help is going to be volunteering at the school. You don't have to just be a foster parent to help rebuild a child's life. I'm going to finish with this. I grew up on Planet Chaos. My mother has mental health issues. She doesn't think right. And so many days I'd come home from school not knowing which mom I'm going to get when I come through the door. The mom that's going to try to choke me and kill me, or the mom that will have a snack waiting for me. My brother's about a year and a half older than me. When we were in high school, the teachers were taking bets on which one of the Wilkinson boys were going to go to prison first. Because we were trouble. I grew up on Planet Chaos, so did my brother. We weren't well liked in the neighborhood. Everybody said, stay away from the Wilkinson boys. My brother served 8 years in prison. I didn't. And I look back on my childhood. And for a long time, I wondered why I walked through a bad train wreck, and I came out of it untouched. How come? How come my best friend fried his brain on drugs by 19? He can't make change on a dollar today, doesn't know who I am. Another good friend of mine was killed driving intoxicated on a bullet bike. My brother went to prison. Percy Stockton, another kid in our circle, was the number one most wanted criminal in the state of California at one time. That's the group. That's my friends. What was the difference between me and them? Well, at age 16, I had a neighbor named Bob Bennett who decided to make a difference. And how it happened was I wanted a car to drive to high school like everybody else. Well, my family couldn't afford a car, and they didn't want me to have a car. So I had to use any method possible to scrounge up $300, and I bought a car with a blown engine. Had it towed to my house, and my dad thought, well, that's the perfect car for you because we don't know anything about cars, and that can't run, so enjoy it. And I did. I polished it and vacuumed it and sat in it and pretended to drive it, but it wouldn't move. But I knew on my street, about three doors down, lived a man by the name of Bob Bennett. I knew he didn't like me, but I also knew inside his garage existed probably every tool God could have ever thought of inventing to work on cars. Seen his garage door open many times. And I figured if anybody could help, maybe he could. And I rode my bike over to Bob Bennett's house and asked him. He was sitting in the garage on a stool staring at me when I rolled up. He told me years later that he contemplated on whether to hop off the stool and put his number 11 boot in my rear end and kick me off the driveway. I'd stolen oranges out of his yard many times. He did not like the Wilkinson boys. He listened to what I had to say and told me that he'd think about it. He went and talked to his wife and thought it over for a few days. He told me all this later. And he said to his wife, I'm going to help him fix that car, but I'm going to, in the process, see if I can fix a boy. What I didn't know was Mr. Bennett had just retired from being a professional automobile mechanic. Couldn't ask a better person. He could fix my car engine probably in 2 days and have me down the road and out of his hair. He didn't. He took almost 3 months. We towed the car to his house, and 6 days a week for hours on end, we would work on that car in his garage together. And for the first couple weeks, I would cry at night because it seemed like it was going nowhere. And my passion was to get that car running, and he was my only hope. But we'd take a part off of that engine and walk over to his workbench, and he'd pull out a scrapbook and start telling me about World War II. He had scrapbooks on his workbench of his World War II stories. Well, he had three scrapbooks. The first one was World War II, and he served on the USS Missouri. And I used to hate those World War II stories. We're never going to get this car fixed. And he wasn't telling World War II stories in the way he's glorifying war. He was telling about the reality of what it's like to be on a ship in a storm, in a battle. His job on that ship was to shoot the 16-inch cannons. The USS Missouri, by the way, it's a museum ship now in Hawaii, if you ever want to go see it. But it had three sets of 16-inch guns, the largest guns we've ever put on a warship. And Mr. Bennett, when he graduated from high school in 1943, he had the unfortunate coincidence of being drafted at the same time the Mighty Mo was rolling out of dry dock. And at boot camp, they asked the recruits, does anybody know how to work on car engines? They needed mechanically minded people, and he raised his hand because he grew up on an orange tree orchard where he repaired tractors with his dad. And so this 18-year-old high school recruit got pulled out of the line and stuck over there and assigned to the USS Missouri and put on gun turret number one. He said, Darren, I didn't want to go to war. He said, by 1943, there was a lot of stars hanging in windows in my neighborhood of boys that weren't coming home. He said, when I got drafted, I told my dad, I don't want to go. And his dad told him, son, sometimes in life, you don't always get to pick the job you have to do, but you can pick how you do it. And he said, son, you go to war and you do your best job, and you'll always have a dad and mom at home that love and respect you. His dad gave him a camera and sent him off, and that's how he arrived at boot camp. On that mighty mill, I could tell Bob Bennett stories for 2 hours. I didn't appreciate these stories until years later. By the end of the summer, I knew all about World War II. I knew all about the Korean War. Yeah, see, when World War II ended, it ended in the harbor of Tokyo, right? Do you remember where the surrender was signed? Anybody? It was on the deck of the USS Missouri. General MacArthur was in charge of the Pacific operations. He was Army, not Navy. And when he had the surrender signed, he had the Mighty Mo brought into the harbor of Tokyo and had the Emperor of Japan come and sign the surrender right underneath the 16-inch guns on gun turret number one. And there sat, by that time, an almost 20-year-old taking pictures, the camera's dad bought him, of the Emperor signing the end of World War II. And there was a scrapbook with pictures to prove it as he's walking me through this. When he got home, he was so happy he kissed the ground and started his life, got married, started a family. In 1950, what happened? Korean War. I didn't know this until I met with Bob Bennett, but once you go in the military once, they can call you back anytime they want. In 1950, he got a letter in the mail from Harry S. Truman, Commander-in-Chief, calling him back to active duty. See, what happened was when the war broke out, they said, we want to put the Mighty Mo on the Korean Peninsula, brought it out in mothballs, and asked the last captain who can shoot these guns. And they said, you want Bennett on those guns. Bennett had to leave two kids, wife and a business, and get back on the Mighty Mo and cruise the Korean Peninsula for 18 months. 1965, the third scrapbook, Lyndon Johnson sent a letter calling him back to active duty because they wanted the Mighty Mo on the shores of Vietnam. He got activated a third time and a scrapbook to prove it. You know, years later, when the History Channel came around and they used to show World War II footage, remember when it was showing that stuff? I'm having lunch one day, History Channel's on, and they show the Mighty Mo, an aerial shot, with the Mighty Mo shooting on one of the islands. I set my sandwich down and watch, because it hits me, Mr. Bennett's on that ship. That footage there I'm watching, that's him shooting at those islands. And I remember the stories he's telling me about it, and the narrator's telling the other half of the story that I don't know that Mr. Bennett ever knew this, but the narrator's saying that the Mighty Mo island hopped all the way through the Pacific. It would arrive 3 days before our Marines would land. It would arrive in an island, and it would pulverize the beachheads from 5 miles out. Did you know our Marines landed untouched all the way through the Pacific because the Japanese couldn't defend the beachheads because of the Mighty Mo? Mr. Bennett wore hearing aids for most of his life because of those guns he fired from 5 miles out. MacArthur had the Emperor of Japan sign underneath the Mighty Mo because it was the Mighty Mo that scared the Japanese Navy the worst because of what it was doing to its islands. It was coming towards Japan. He wanted to put the fear of God in the Emperor of Japan, don't ever mess with us again. And there sat that young recruit on that gun turret, who got called back for the Korean War, called back for the Vietnam War. Did you know he served less than 5 years in the United States Navy and never got a pension? Wore hearing aids for most of his life and never expected a pension. I tell you this story because that's the man who, by the end of the summer, working with Mr. Bennett, he'd become my hero. He had changed my blueprint, my operational blueprint. And ironically, when we get this car running, I drive it over to my best friend Claire's house to show him my car. He gets in, and he's got drugs on him. The summer I'm in the garage rebuilding a car engine is the summer he starts experimenting with drugs, and he wants me to try drugs. I can't because what would Mr. Bennett think of me? he'd become my hero. You can watch a direct division in my path and everyone else around me's path from about 16 on. I couldn't. Mr. Bennett would come to my house at least twice a month, pull up in his red F-Ford 250, and ask me to come help him. I would ride in his truck feeling like the proudest kid in the neighborhood. We'd go get manure for his orange trees, or we'd go get a part for his lawnmower. He never took in one foster kid or adopted one kid. But he had a gift, and he used it. We heal through relationships. So my challenge to you is, hey, if it's not going to be foster care for adoption, pick some child and make a difference through your relationship with them, through your loving, kind, caring relationship. Help make their life have brighter hope and a brighter future. Thank you for letting me come here and share some thoughts with you. We need all the help we can get.
At the end, when God brings this all about and he takes account of everything, there's a story in the Bible where Jesus says, hey, thanks, come on in. Because you remember when I was hungry and you fed me and I was naked and you clothed me and I didn't have a home and you gave me a place to sleep? You remember that? And the people are like, nope. He said, well, whatever you did to the least of those people, I took that personally. You were doing that to me. And so, as Darren said, it used to be the church's responsibility, and I would like it to become that again. So we will care for the people who are hungry and naked and homeless. And Jesus will look at us and say, I recognize you. I've seen you before. That's our responsibility. We're going to pray and close. And if you are interested in learning more about becoming actively involved in foster care and adoption, or maybe even being just an advocate for children, you can stay after. We're going to have lunch, and it's provided. But thank you for your time, and I'm looking forward to what God is going to use us to do. Let's pray. Thank you, God, for reminding us of all of your creation, and thank you for relighting a fire in us to care for everyone. Show us, please, how you want us, each one of us, to take responsibility for the people in our lives, and whether it's an active role or it's just someone that we, well, they're all active, whether it's through foster care or whether it's just grabbing a hold of someone at church or our neighbor. Show us what you want us to do, and we will obey. And it's in Jesus' name we ask. Amen. Hope you have a good week.